Before we begin today's show, I have some important news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is generous friends of the ministry have offered a new $5,000 matching grant, which will double your gift today up to that amount. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And this episode is a kind of follow-on from our episode from a few weeks ago where we talked about a fascinating story from the United States, a Christian IVF doctor who felt increasingly concerned about how IVF is traditionally practiced. And has followed his conscience to set up a Christian, explicitly Christian IVF clinic that pursues IVF in quite a different way around things like genetic testing, discarding embryos, surplus embryos, those sorts of things. If you haven't heard that episode, probably worth pausing this one and going back to listen to that, because today we wanted to kind of move the conversation on and talk more generally about some of the big ethical questions that IVF and fertility treatment raise for believers. Because it's not just those kind of narrow technical issues that we talked about what to do with surplus embryos or how, what kind of things is it appropriate to do pre-implantation genetic testing on, but it also raises really profound questions about things like parenthood and identity, what it means to be human, are we constructed or begotten. So we're going to get into all of that, but before we start, we do want to acknowledge, as we did last time, that this is a really sensitive and painful topic. There'll be people listening, we're very aware, who are themselves experiencing infertility, who may be longing for a child and not able to have one, maybe people who have conceived through IVF. So we don't want to, we want to give people a warning. This may not be right for everyone to listen to, but also we want to say that we approach this with a level of kind of sensitivity, and we're trying to be thoughtful and gentle, because this is a really, can be a really raw topic for some people.
Absolutely. And we it's something that, you know, over the years, I've had the privilege of having conversations with many individuals and couples who've experienced the pain of infertility, sometimes despite many, many attempts at IVF and so on. And I'm aware that this is a kind of silent pain, which is not very often recognized, and that the church, local church activities can unintentionally be extremely insensitive.
That's right. I've heard lots of people who experience this talking about how hard it can be to be in church settings where there's such a, as you say, such a focus on families and children as a kind of unalloyed good, and it's often people suffering in silence. So yeah, I think part of our hope is that we want these conversations to encourage people in the Christian community to not suffer in silence, to have these often painful and costly, but have these conversations more openly, so that, you know, particularly for those who haven't yet started trying to have children, like, this could happen to you, and it's much healthier and easier to have started thinking through what do we believe as Christians about infertility and reproductive technologies before it's really strikes home at you very personally.
Yeah, and as I've sort of wrestled over the years with this technology and read and discussed with others, one of the things that really strikes me is the way that the very development of IVF, which goes back to the 1960s and 1970s, has actually changed how we understand ourselves. And it's a sort of classic paradigm case of how technology, which was originally introduced by doctors trying to find a way of helping infertile couples to have babies turns out to have remarkable social, philosophical, personal consequences.
Yeah, because I think I'm not 100% on the history here. You can correct me, but it was pioneered by some British researchers, and they were really trying to address a rare complication, which is that when something has gone wrong with a woman's fallopian tubes, which connect the ovaries and the womb, and so if an egg cannot pass down from the ovaries to the womb, you can't have children. And they were trying to kind of address that, and it kind of only expanded from that point to become this kind of first line treatment for all other sorts of infertility.
Yeah, it's not that rare. It's one, you know, as we've said before, fertility affects 1 in 7 couples, and problems, often infection, adhesions, abnormalities of the fallopian tubes is one of the common causes of infertility. So it's not that rare, but nonetheless, it was motivated by medical concerns, and it was two doctors, Steptoe, who was an obstetrician gynecologist, and Edwards, who was an embryologist, and in the process they were attempting this technology with many unsuccessful attempts for over years, but eventually the first child of the world's first quote test tube baby was called Louise Brown. She was born in 1978, so she's just 50 something,
yeah,
nearly 50.
Yeah, so this is still a relatively new technology in the consequence of, you know, human beings have been sadly experiencing infertility for tens of thousands of years, and yet it's had quite profound implications on how I think certainly us in the kind of wealthy West, for whom there is greatest access to IVF, think about ourselves, think about reproduction. It's had this effect of almost disaggregating, breaking down the various component parts. You sometimes use the metaphor of kind of Lego, don't you, that people kind of now seem to think, well, because we can literally take the sperm here and the egg here and connect them in a petri dish and then re-implant them, and then some says, well, hang on, well, does the sperm have to come from the husband of the woman? What about if the sperm came from another man? Or maybe the egg doesn't have to come from the person whose womb we're going to re-implant it. So you can start to introduce genetic material and cells from other people, and you end up with this, actually, quite reductionist approach that reproduction, you just need an egg, a sperm, a womb, and they could come from three different people who have no relationship at all.
That's right. And in fact, it's interesting, even in the shift in the word from procreation to reproduction, procreation is a biological process, a natural process. Reproduction is by definition a kind of technological manufacturing concept. And as you say, you just need an egg, a sperm, a womb, and then you need someone who's going to look after the baby when it's born. And there's no fundamental reasons why any of those four components should be related to each other. Mm. And therefore there are a huge number of permutations and combinations of how we put those four things together.
There was that famous case we've discussed on the podcast before, sometimes called the Google baby, where there was a woman, I think she was in the United States, and she decided that she would like a child, but she didn't want to do it the traditional way. And so she put up adverts online and through Google found an egg donor, a sperm donor, a surrogate mother, we could call them a womb donor. And together, those three people using IVF formed an embryo, implanted it into the surrogate mother. And it was only when the child was actually born that this woman, the intended parent, the commissioning parent, somebody's called, actually kind of took over care. So this child had four parents, effectively. None of the four had any previous or ongoing relationship whatsoever.
That's right. And the only reason it came to public notice was because there was then a legal tussle between the surrogate mother, who was not convinced that the commissioning mother was actually fit to be a suitable mother. And therefore, there was then a legal case, which is why it hit the headlines. I'm quite certain there have been many, many Google babies, you know, that have never hit the headlines. There's no law preventing it. And of course, this has created all kinds of legal concerns. Who is the real mother?
Yes.
And this, apparently, I think it varies in different states in the US. It varies in different countries. But the UK has been very clear that it's the carrying mother, in other words, the one who carries the baby in her womb, who is the legal mother. And I think the reason for that is that that's the one relationship which is not open to question or legal challenge.
Though that is up for debate at the moment. As we discuss, surrogacy rules in the UK are kind of being consulted on, and the recommendation from the Law Commission, which is kind of non-partisan body that recommends changes to laws, is that the Britain should shift away from that system. So currently, as you say, the way it works is that a child commissioned via surrogacy, and often involving IVF as well, is the legal parent is the mother who has carried that child for 9 months. And so what really happens, even though people like to obfuscate this, is that child is then adopted by their commissioning parents, and they, you know, a judge has to make an adoption order, and the woman has to voluntarily relinquish her parenthood over that child. And this, I think, is a good system. I think it's a healthy, good way to do it. But the recommendation, which hasn't yet been implemented, but it's been considered, is that we change that so that it's automatic, so that actually, when the child is born, legal parenthood transfers to the surrogate, the commissioning parents, automatically, and doesn't require either the surrogate mother's consent or a separate application to a court to transfer parenthood, which is more similar to what happens in some other jurisdictions, but I think personally is a mistake.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's just an example of how unforeseen consequences. So one of the other fascinating events is that changes in the law is that until recently, technically, every child would have a father and a mother in law. And even if it was not known who the father was, still, in theory, out there is a father who could be identified and who has legal responsibilities and duties.
And with DNA, that identification is actually in perpetuity possible, even if, you know, in the olden days, you could never really prove. But now, you know, if someone came forward, they could spit into a tube and prove beyond all reasonable doubt that they are this child's father.
That's right. And of course, in speaking to a child understands that, you know, I have a mummy and a daddy. And I remember hearing somebody where it was a single mother who was trying to explain, yes, that's right. Her child, aged 5, asked the single mother, you know, you're my mummy, but where is my daddy? And she said, well, you don't have your daddy. In fact, I'm both your daddy and your mummy. And this 5-year-old says, no, you're not. Mummies are girls and daddies are boys.
Yes, out of the mouths of babes, indeed. And so I think it's fascinating, isn't it? One, as you say, one example of that, when Steptoe and Edwards were foofling around in a lab in the late 1960s and early 1970s trying to fix this kind of interesting technical problem of fallopian tubes.
Foofling around in the lab, I have to say, as a
sorry. Pioneering groundbreaking research
indeed.
At the cutting edge of science. They had no idea or intention to rip up mankind's long understood notions of parenthood, and yet barely 40 years later, the UK government was changing the law to redefine parenthood. So a 2008 law introduced a system whereby if you have a same-sex couple who use IVF to get pregnant, obviously they cannot produce the sperm themselves, but the man who produces the sperm is no longer legally the child's parent. On the birth certificate, it will be the carrying woman's partner, female partner, will become the second parent.
That's right. And this is called the agreed female parenthood conditions. So effectively, the carrying mother can choose which other female she wishes to be legally become the parent. And the bill then goes on to say that in where two women have become parents, the bill states that no man will be the father of the child. In other words, a child conceived in this way has no possibility of ever having a legal father.
Yes, and there are parallel arrangements for two men in the same way.
So it is remarkable, isn't it? Because up until, you know, for thousands of years, parenthood was defined by the biology.
Yeah.
But now, post-IVF, parenthood is actually defined by contract, or at least can be. It becomes, you know, autonomous.
Yeah.
The father, the mother, the parent is the person I have chosen to play that role.
Mm. And people are trying to push this further and further, you know, so there is research underway to try and find a way so that two same-sex couples could both be biologically related to the child. And we might have discussed this, I can't remember, on a previous episode, but, you know, doing various whizzy things with cells and sperm and eggs to try and basically take so that the child has some kind of genetic biological relationship with both their fathers or both their mothers. And I have no doubt, if it is possible, I don't know if it's genetically possible, but if it is biologically possible, one day science will find a way to turn a sperm into an egg or vice versa, so that you could literally have a same-sex couple be the sole biological progenitors of their child. There will be a demand for that. I have no idea if it's feasible, but there will be a demand for that if it can be done.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And again, this comes back to the sort of Lego kit, you know, that there must be a way of taking that red bit and somehow squeezing it.
We just turn this around upside down, or cut it in half, or blast it with something in radiation in the lab to try and make it mutate into something else. Yeah. And I think it's easy for Christians to kind of recoil and kind of roll their nose at this stuff. But let's be a bit more thoughtful. We do lots of radical, crazy stuff in other medical treatments. You know, I think about any number of crazy genetic therapies that are now possible for types of cancer and stuff, where we're getting down to the molecular, cellular level of the human body and doing some crazy, radical stuff. Why is that okay? And messing around with the particular cells involved in reproduction, something that Christians should be concerned about?
Yeah, and actually, this has been a big issue of debate in medical ethics and philosophy. So, you know, the standard approach of medicine is restorative. We are restoring damaged and malfunctioning or even absent bits of the body, and the aim being to restore the human body back to health. But when we're doing reproductive technology, the argument goes, is this genuinely restorative, or are we actually sort of inventing new, is this a creative and even an enhancing kind of therapy? And so there have been big debates about this. So for instance, you know, when IVF first came, you know, should the NHS, should our taxpayers' money be going towards this form of technology which isn't helping diseased people, helping people who are dying from this is helping people who are infertile. Infertility was not generally regarded as a disease in the same sense of cancer. It's certainly not a life-threatening but of course, others come along and say, but in reality, infertility is just as devastating as having cancer.
And maybe more so. I mean, it's not like the NHS only treats you if you're at death's door. You know, you could go with some eczema, which never killed anyone, and the NHS will take it seriously, and they have a whole cadre of dermatologists and researchers trying to find ways to treat eczema. Isn't experiencing infertility it has much more deleterious effect on our well-being than eczema does.
But as we've just said, okay, that will apply to a married couple. But what about a single woman who desperately wants to have a baby? Mm. You know, is that a disease at the NHS? What about a same-sex couple? You know,
what is the answer? Does our taxpayer state funded system provide IVF for single people or straight same-sex couples?
Well, I think it's a grey area, and it often depends on the particular local rules. Different commissioning groups within the NHS have different rules. And historically, they would say you have to be in a stable relationship, you have to demonstrate, you know, all these different hoops. Once you've met those criteria, then you are justified, and maybe we will offer you, say, 3 cycles for free, or maybe only 1 cycle of IVF for free. After that, you're going to have to pay. How, you know, we can't discriminate against same-sex couples, so now we've agreed that we'd do this for heterosexual couples. We have to do that for same-sex couples. What about a single person? Well, you know, we've got to think about the welfare of the child. Are you going to be able to cope? And so on. You can just see how all the complexities of how the funding bodies can try and address this.
And of course, in there's always, for those who have the resources, you can go private. And, you know, if you're a single person, you have the money, I'm sure you can find a reproductive clinic somewhere that will happily try and make you a mother or a father.
Well, particularly because you don't have to... The rules in the UK are very strict because of the HFEA Act and the fact that there's criminal sanctions if clinics go outside the rules. But so-called reproductive tourism means you could go... Yeah. You know, as we remember before the war in Ukraine was one of the primary places where you could go and have surrogacy, you could have embryos created... many European countries offer private fertility treatments, and then the question is, you know, you as a British person travel to some distant country, you have IVF, you then return, you know, does the NHS have the duty to pick up the pieces after you've been through this process?
And there's also complex legal questions about what is the status of the child that you come back with. Are they a British citizen? If they were born originally to non-British citizens in a non-UK territory, but the British couple who come back with this child very much believe that this child is their child, and yeah, it gets messy, and you get these kind of transnational custody disputes, and yeah, there's been several cases of that in the news. There's also the another issue we haven't discussed before about egg sharing, which is where some IVF clinics will offer sharply reduced or even free IVF treatment on the condition that the mother agrees to give away some of the eggs that have been harvested in the process to be used for other couples who can't produce their own eggs at all.
Yes, absolutely. And this is because there's a very severe shortage of suitable eggs for use in IVF for a number of reasons, particularly that many people who go towards IVF are often older women in their late 30s or 40s, and so-called quality of the eggs is often much lower than in younger people. Women and therefore they need egg donation, but there's a shortage of younger women who are prepared to go through the whole process of hyperovulation, harvesting of eggs, and so on, in the desire to then help other people have babies. And so the egg sharing scheme is something that some private clinics have, and as you say, you're offered cut price IVF or sometimes even free IVF, but the proviso is a significant number of the eggs that you create in the process of going through the IVF treatment are taken and shared with one or more other couples. The clinic can effectively do whatever it likes with the eggs that you've donated.
And then I guess it comes down to if you're the mother that's done this and those other eggs are later used in successful cycles of IVF and grow up to be children, are they your children or are they just someone else's children and it's just like giving your blood to someone? You know, I'm a blood donor. Some of my blood is currently flowing around the veins of some strangers out there. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't keep me up at night. It's just blood. It doesn't feel like I've given anything away of myself. I don't have any claim or stake on that. But with children, it feels a bit different.
Yeah, well, and this is where donating a gamete is very different from donating blood or even donating a kidney or some other organ. The because of the nature of biology, gametes, a sperm or an egg, has very, very significant implications because that is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, in a sort of strange way. Mm. Even though this egg is microscopic, it reflects all the relationships that go on of me and my family and are all enshrined in this genetic material. And of course, the HFEA grappled with the question of should children born by IVF be allowed to know the origin of their genetic origin? And the answer is yes. Once you get to 18, the HFEA Act allows now, I can contact, if I know, of course I've got to be informed by my parents that I'm created by embryo donation and many... or
I wonder how many parents...
Absolutely right.
...find the time to tell their
but
kids.
But even that. If I suspect it, sometimes I just suspect that I'm clearly not genetically related to my father and my mother, and I wonder. And so I can contact the HFEA, give them all my details, and the HFEA will tell me who my genetic parents are.
And this caused, I remember, a bit of a kind of media storm when the rules changed, because there was the newspapers were salivating at the idea of that, you know, some bored student donated sperm 20 years ago and never thought about it again until the doorbell rings and his long lost son or daughter says, "Hi Dad, I've tracked you down." I don't know if that ever actually really happened, but it's a kind of tantalizing, salacious prospect.
Yeah, and I think the HFEA Act makes it clear that you don't have any financial or other responsibilities.
Yes. You can't be called on for child support.
It's quite. Or, come on, Dad, I'm broke. As has been known by biological children, if I may say so, Tim.
Unheard of.
But I think that it is clearly extraordinary. And you know, we can laugh about it, but I think it's one of the reasons why there's been a huge reluctance, understandably, for people in the UK to donate either sperm or eggs because of the potential long-term ramifications.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a new $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today up to that amount. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as there is a final funding gap of $94,000 that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to please give your very best gift right now to close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I think that strikes us as something quite instructive we should dwell on for a second, because the way that the doctors and a lot of popular culture would have you believe, these are just cells. It's an altruistic, compassionate act. It's just like giving blood or giving a kidney. You know, you produce, you know, if you're a man, you produce billions of these sperm cells over your lifetime. Like, who cares? And eggs, again, women are born with tens of thousands of eggs they'll never use, locked up in their ovaries. Surely there should be a superfluity, abundance of these gametes. And yet, the great British public has, by and large, said, no, I don't want to donate my sperm, I don't want to donate my eggs, to the point where, as we discussed in previous episodes, you have these weird rogue kind of Facebook groups of, like, you know, like that random Dutch guy who's got hundreds of children around the world because he won't stop going around advertising his sperm. You know, you have these oddballs and weirdos who are filling in the gap, because there is not a steady stream of like sober, ordinary, compassionate, altruistic people queuing up to donate sperm and eggs to these biobanks, effectively.
Yeah, and I think this is where a good point to try and sort of pivot now towards thinking about this from a Christian point of view, because what this is tapping into is some very, very deep human intuitions, isn't it? About parenthood, about children, about families, about relations. And it's interesting, as I was sort of reflecting on this, you know, years ago when I was first trying to write about reproductive technology and the ethics of it, it struck me, you know, forcibly again how significant the genealogies are in the Old Testament. I mean, throughout the Bible narrative, the relationships of who was the father of who, and, you know, being within a genetic line, who was the mother, who was the father, how was, you know, that God so often works through genealogical relationships.
Yes. And these, the Bible story is grounded in a culture which was a kind of kinship culture, where the before the birth of the kind of modern state, the primary way society was organized was around tribe and family. Who is your kin? Those are the people that you relied on to provide for you when you were sick and ill. Those are the people who you had obligations and duties to. And it wasn't the kind of narrow nuclear family of just your siblings and your parents that we have in the Western industrialized world, but these kind of kinship relationships sprawled to endless cousins and people that you might not have grown up with, but you knew we are kin. I owe you something. You owe me something. We have a bond that is stronger. You know, blood is thicker than water, as the saying goes.
Yeah, and in the chapter of Genesis, isn't it? In the book of Genesis, there's that shift. The first 11 chapters are really humanity, by and large. It's humanity as a whole. Although there's Noah, isn't there? And the children of Noah. But it's really, the shift comes at Genesis 12, when God's focus is now on Abraham and the seed. By your seed will be greater than the stars of the heaven. You know that there's a genealogical relationship that God Himself has chosen one genealogy as being the means. Now it's not racism in the sense that everyone else is inferior, but it is a particularity that God is choosing one man ultimately, and or one line from which the whole of the covenants is going to come through.
But is that something that New Testament moves away from? I mean, you know, remember that interesting exchange where Jesus is talking with the Pharisees about who is children of Abraham, and he says, well, God could raise children of Abraham out of these stones on the ground if he wanted to. And then you have the expanding story across Acts, where the early kind of very Jewish church is kind of challenged by the Holy Spirit and by the apostles and by God's direct miraculous intervention to say, no, this story is going to go beyond people who have any relationship to Abraham. It's going to go beyond the Jews to the Gentiles. God's new covenant family is not genealogical, it's spiritual. And that's why you and I, Gentiles, that tens of thousands of miles away from the ancient Near East desert where Abraham was pitching his tent, can call themselves part of God's family. Because have we now broken that strict kind of bloodline kinship theology, covenant theology?
Yeah, no, I think we have, and I think it's a very, very important theme, isn't it? That and it's Jesus is already referring to it, as you say, and then it's particularly with the Pentecost miracle, isn't it, that all of a sudden the Spirit is now at work in people of every tribe and tongue and nation, and that's the vision in the future. So it's actually the family of humanity now. That becomes, but family relationships are, so at one level, I suppose, the New Testament subverts the physical genealogy, but it never, I mean, the importance of family relationships are still supported, caring for families, but it's so there's a balance here. I think you can overemphasize the subversion of family relationships completely. Mm. And you know, but the teaching of the New Testament epistles is that those who abandon their families, because there clearly was in the early church, wasn't there? There were the extremists who said, you know,
great, leave my wife and kids behind. I'm on the Jesus
they
train
don't count
now.
Anymore. I'm a Christian, and the apostles clearly strongly said that both marriage relationships were important and parent-child relationships were mm-hmm. were very important. So it's subverted in one level, but it is still maintained because it's part of the created order. You know, this is the way that God chose. And part of that, I would say, is this tag that I've often used, making love and making babies belong together, that the creation order places the procreation of the species within the unitive relationship of a man and a woman.
And this gets back to what we talked about at the start, the way that IVF and related fertility treatments have broken down the constituent parts of reproduction of procreation and encouraged us to adopt that Lego kit mentality. And actually, I think as believers, the Christian tradition, as you say, resists that idea that you can disaggregate the various elements and says, actually, you know, it's sometimes the kind of Ponce theological term is the procreative unitive bond, that it wasn't a coincidence that the way God set it up is that man and wife in the act of physical intimacy and having sex is also the way that children, the only way that children can be born. And the fact that we have, with our clever technology, found out a way to break apart those two things is something that we should be perhaps a bit sceptical about.
Yeah, and you know, for me, this was a theology which was brought home so strongly when our own children were born, you know, because, you know, before we had any children, the relationship between Celia and me was an entirely immaterial, sort of spiritual, psychological, you know, wonderful. There was this unique combination of John and Celia, and it was wonderful. And nobody had ever seen this relationship, such a wonderful relationship between John and Celia. But it was entirely sort of spiritual. And then something utterly bizarre happens, because this unique combination of John and Celia is now written becomes flesh, it becomes incarnate. And I know it's all
in
a
profoundly disappointing sense.
Indeed, and I know this is all a bit toe-curling to talk about this to your own son, but you know, the fact remains that in your DNA is the combination of John and Celia, which the world has never seen before. And it is passed on down the generations. So there is something really quite remarkable there, that, in other words, God's plan should be that, you know, if you think about it, if you were to look into your DNA, you could in theory see all the innumerable couplings all the way back to the first common ancestors, you know, our genetic Adams and Eves. Your entire body is composed of innumerable human couplings, people who chose to make love and make babies.
Yeah. And I think in some ways the discovery of DNA, which again is a relatively historically recent, the 1950s and 60s, is a wonderful way in which the more that we probe into the wonders of God's created order, it can kind of buttress what we already believed and what we'd already been told through scripture. You know, we already had... The Christian tradition for thousands of years has been that we are, you know, part of this one human family. And now we can literally see in ones and zeros in the code when we decode our genome that is literally true. And we have pierced the veil and understood a little bit of a fragment more about the precise mechanism by which God has built into our created order that, as you say, every human being is a unique recombination of the genetic code of their parents, who are themselves a unique recombination genetic code of their parents, and so on and so forth, all the way back, in theory, to Adam and Eve.
And that's why, you know, as I was trying to wrestle with and continue to wrestle with, how do we think about this from a Christian point of view? My feeling is that if we are using IVF and reproductive technology to retain that genetic link between a husband and father, between people who are committed to one another within a family relationship, so that, yes, the reproductive technology is very advanced and sophisticated, but fundamentally the creation order is being retained. I would argue that, yes, there are all kinds of issues and questions and so on, but fundamentally that is reinforcing the creation order. Whereas once I enter into gamete donation or sharing or surrogacy, I'm breaking this fundamental created order, and the consequences of that, I think, are often extraordinary and unpredictable.
Mm. So I suppose you could make the case that, you know, there are lots of things that we do to people which are artificial, you know, basic hip replacement, you know. Tens, hundreds of millions of human beings now walk around with metal joints. That's clearly not God's created plan. God's plan was that we would have joints made of cartilage and bone. But no one, I think, seriously questions whether that is an ethically appropriate thing to do, because your hip is breaking down, it's causing pain and suffering, and we can now, we've developed surgical techniques to do hip replacements that give people years more of good life. And because it is heat cleaving back to clearly the way hips were supposed to work, was they're supposed to rotate and move without pain and all that stuff. So if you're saying, if we do IVF where we're very careful to use only the sperm and the egg from the husband and wife, and we are careful, as we talked last time, not to produce lots of surplus embryos that will end up frozen or destroyed, and we're careful not to do lots of extensive genetic testing to find the right embryo, but we just produce the embryo, and the only difference to God's created order is that rather than the mixing happening in the fallopian tubes and then the fertilized egg traveling down into the uterus and implanting, that first 3 or 4 days takes place outside of the body in a test tube in the lab. That's effectively equivalent of a hip replacement. It's artificial, it's mechanistic, but it's fundamentally ethically appropriate, because it's just using technology to try and do what couldn't be achieved along the tram lines of the way God wanted human bodies to work.
Yes, I think I want to argue that that is restorative technology. We are trying to restore the body to the original creation order. And we've talked about this before, but I do think the analogy of an art restoration is an interesting analogy, because art restorers have a code of ethics, and what it says is basically the original artist's intention is normative. Whatever you do, you know, when you're working on a Rembrandt, you're not free to say, I honestly think it'd be so much better if we sort of, you know, put in some, change the lighting, or, you know, made this a bit. You know, it is what Rembrandt wanted that is normative, but I can use incredibly sophisticated new technologies. Mm. I can use artificial polyurethane paints, which have the same characteristic of 16th century Flemish or whatever materials. So because it is the intention that matters, not the technology.
Yes.
And so my argument, therefore, is that if our intention is to maintain the original artist's goals, then it doesn't matter how sophisticated the technology. But once we're changing the design, so that the argument goes, once we use donor gametes or surrogacy, we're changing the design. That's not the way in which we were intended to make babies, by making love and making babies.
And this idea leads us nicely on to quite a major feature of particularly Catholic social teaching and ethics, which is often called the idea of natural theology. So where they kind of look at the world as it is and say, what is what ought to be. And hence why Catholics take quite a strong opposition to contraception. or at least the church does, it's widely known, and people will tell you in surveys that ordinary Catholics are quite happy to use contraception on the main. But the Catholic Church's teaching is opposed to contraception, largely, again, because they say, look, the way it was set up, the way it was designed, you can discern from the order of creation that God intended sex, every sex act, to be at least open to the possibility of procreation. We acknowledge, of course, that not every time a couple have sex does a child form, but it is at least a theoretical possibility. And so therefore, introducing some form of contraception is interfering with God's design and procreative intention. I guess the question I always have, or the kind of wonder I have, is this is kind of presupposed, and that when we look at the world as it is, we can accurately discern the creator's intention. But as actually, as traditional Christian theology will say, created order was itself also harmed by mankind's sin in the fall. And therefore, what we see around us is not always obviously God's intention. You can see that very clearly with, you know, say, I'm happy to go on record to say, I don't think it was God's intention that people get cancer. But we know that cells mutate and grow tumours all the time. All cells do this in all contexts. And yeah, it produces deep human suffering. It's not God's intention. So there is a work to be done, an ethical discernment work to be done, to say, I can't just look at the world as it is and say, this is how I need to make it to be. I have to try and peel back some of the layers of how it's been warped and twisted by the effects of the fall and sin and death and destruction, to try and discern what was the original creative intention.
Absolutely right. And this is a huge and complicated philosophical, theological issue, and one that there's a lot of controversy about. There are people, Christian scientists and others, who would say that, you know, genetic mutation is essential for evolution to take place, and therefore genetic disorders are an inevitable part of the creation, and that to say that these are some kind of natural evil, which is what historically has often been said by theologians, doesn't make sense. So these are very complex issues, and we're not here to try and solve them. Another issue is whether the created order is absolutely fixed as an unchangeable reality, or whether there's a sense in which, as the world develops and as human society develops, that things that were... Is it possible that the created order is in some way a much more fluid and a flexible thing, but rather than something that's absolutely rigid and fixed?
And has God asked human beings to, in some sense, co-create with him and to steward and take... You know, we often talk about this idea that the narrative of Scripture is from a garden to a city. Starts in Genesis 1 with a garden and ends in Revelation with a city. Cities are, on one level, human constructions, where we've taken the raw materials of stone and soil and earth and built them into something that never occurs in God's natural design. And yet, maybe that was part of God's plan, was that creation wasn't fixed at that moment, and our job is not necessarily to return to this kind of pure, unsullied creation, but actually to develop and... within God's kind of kingdom purposes, develop into something new.
Absolutely right, and this is a sort of deep theological divide and debate which continues into between theologians, who would all say that they're trying to be faithful to an orthodox, historic, biblical Christian faith, and yet coming to different conclusions. And I think, interestingly, in the future, this is really going to be very important when it comes to human enhancement.
Yes.
You know, how do we as Christians think about, as it becomes technologically possible to actually change our human design, you know, as it becomes possible, for instance, to maybe extend life longevity to 120 or 150 years, as it becomes possible, for instance, to increase our muscular strength, or maybe even our IQ and intellectual abilities with technology, you know, is this something that Christians should say absolutely no way, you know, we believe in the original model humanity, or are, should Christians say, well, God is giving us this new, you know, this is all part of his plan for the species, that we should be able to modify? And I think these are hugely complex. I think, to be, you know, to put my hand up, I am what would be called a bioconservative. You know, I think I am, my inclinations are to say, and I do that because of the incarnation. It seems to me that in the incarnation, God has given a kind of final vote of confidence in old-fashioned Mark I humanity,
unenhanced. That's quite... And it's another way that, again, when Steptoe and Edwards were doing their research in the 70s, they had no idea that they would be ushering, you know, a new wave of liberal eugenics. But as we've discussed in this podcast before, it is impossible to conceive of what people are now toying with. Can we only kind of, can we select our children on the grounds of their capacities? Is only possible because of IVF, because that embryo is outside the human body. You can then do extensive genetic testing, and you can pick and choose between 30 different embryos to pick the right one. So without the IVF technology, none of this other stuff coming down the track is conceivable.
Yes, I would just point out that, in fact, these ideas predate Steptoe and Edwards, because if you think of Aldous Huxley, Brave New World.
No, that's,
they've
absolutely
already
right.
got reproductive technology, and it's very much socially controlled in order to enhance the alphas, you know, the small number of alphas that we need, but then keep the rest down at the epsilon.
And that's a society, if you haven't read the novel, where the state takes over reproduction entirely, and that no one is being born au naturel out of the process of making love between husband and wife, but that they're made in factories, and that's how the state is able to deliberately stunt some of them to make them these kind of worker drones, and has this tiny elite, and kind of creates this class system encoded in our very bodies. And this is published in the 1930s.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very interesting to see the roots of transhumanism and all this stuff. As so often, it's science fiction and philosophical speculation which predates the actual technology. But the technology comes along and catches up. And these ideas, which have just been purely speculative and largely cautionary. I mean, Aldous Huxley wrote that not to say,
you know, let's usher in the future. Yeah. Brave New World is not a world that Aldous Huxley wants us to live in.
You know, this is a dystopia, but it's something he saw because it was being talked about. So anyway, we've gone quite a long way.
There's just one other thing I wanted to bring in before we come to a close. And that is, you sometimes hear Catholic theologians, people talk about how we've created a kind of contraceptive culture that, again, the invention of contraception and its kind of dissemination from the post-war era onwards, no one intended necessarily for that to change how we view the act of sex. But it has, 60, 70, 80 years down the line, profoundly across the world, meant that there are generations growing up who no longer see sex as intimately connected with procreation. But there is sex for fun, and then there's separately, sometimes people make a very conscious decision to come off contraception and take their folic acid pills and measure their basal mucus levels and all this stuff. They're having sex purely for babies, and everyone else is having sex for fun. And I guess the question is the growing spread of IVF and the way it continues to kind of penetrate not just those who are infertile, but kind of broader cultural thinking, are we creating an IVF culture where we're going to permanently change how our society thinks about children and parenthood and identity and procreation?
Yeah, and I think the short answer is yes. It is interesting that when contraception, particularly the pill, first surfaced, Catholics, theologians and the magisterium of the Catholic Church was totally clear that this was wrong, whereas Protestant theologians, including a large majority of evangelicals, in fact saw no problem with it. And it's interesting in that sense that I think the Catholics were prescient in seeing what the wider implications would
downstream,
be.
What's coming.
And I suspect the same is true about reproductive technology, and certainly this breaking of the link between making love and making babies. Now, as we've talked before, the idea in particular, what reproductive technology is, it gives you access to the embryo, which of course previously you never could. You know, now the embryo is in a dish. Now we can really get to work on, you know, pulling it apart, selecting, changing, enhancing, changing.
And how long will it be before that stuff starts to become not just selecting which embryo you want, but doing direct DNA editing of that embryo using CRISPR and other technologies to say, we'll take this embryo, we're not content with what the random mutation, random combination of DNA has been, so we'll start adding in some other genes, taking out some genes to try and create our own, like, super baby. You know, it's not far away.
I fear it isn't. And the point about this technology is that although, you know, mainstream societies like the UK and the US and elsewhere can restrict it and have even draconian laws, there's nothing to stop this going on in offshore islands and laboratories around the world. It's relatively straightforward to set up an IVF lab these days. So it's not a technology which can be controlled by state power.
No. And there was that story, wasn't there, of that Chinese scientist who kind of went rogue and started doing some germline editing when he wasn't supposed to. I mean, it's a bit like new technology, you know, once the genie's out the bottle, it's never going back.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to bring this to an end, you know, as I wrestled with all this, I was left with the question, what would we have done if we had not been able to have children? Would we have gone for IVF? And I think, knowing now what I know and having sort of agonized about it, I don't think either we would have decided to go for IVF. And I think we would have felt we would want to try some natural fertility treatments. And if that didn't work, we would be open to adopting children. And I think that Oliver O'Donovan summed it up very well when he said that sometimes God calls individuals, and these are Oliver O'Donovan's words, to accept exclusion from the created good as the necessary price of a true and unqualified witness to it. In other words, by refraining from going down this IVF route, a childless couple may bear witness to God's good creation order while they themselves recognize that I'm excluded from part of the blessings of that order.
Which is, you know, we just have to say it's a hard teaching. It's a hard conclusion to draw, because the pain felt by childless couples is not wrong. They're not wrong to long for children. Children are a blessing. Children are a gift. Children are a good thing. It is right for people to want to become parents. And so it could feel cruel to say the responsible Christian is to not utilize what science has offered you, which is a chance to have children. But I think there is something profound in the idea that actually, as O'Donovan says, by voluntarily choosing to kind of self-exclude from children and not going down the IVF route, we say something quite powerful about what we believe God's created order is. We say something quite profound about what we think true parenthood or what we believe is good about the way God set up our bodies. And in some ways, it's comparable to those Christians who are gay or same-sex attracted but choose to remain celibate because they believe that by excluding themselves from the possibilities of marriage and sex and loving relationships, though exceptionally costly and painful, it is a way of them witnessing to what they believe is good about the way God has set up marriage, sex and relationships.
Yeah, it's a deep mystery and a deeply spiritual human thing, isn't it? I really believe the way that God made it is good. If I believe that with all my heart, that means that I personally can't benefit from that. But in choosing not to, I am bearing witness to its goodness.
Well, we'd love to know your thoughts on some of the big ideas we've been wrestling with on today's episode, and indeed the previous one about the different approaches to IVF. As we said, we don't want to stand in judgment over what people have decided to do in conscience. We just want to try and encourage a conversation for Christians of all different sorts to think hard about some of the complex dilemmas that our scientific and technological advances have thrown up for us. We'd love to know your thoughts. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What have we forgotten? What have we missed? Please do get in touch. You can email MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And there's also lots of material on Dad's website on a lot of these medical ethics issues around the start of life in particular. If you're interested in reading more, you can find that at johnwyatt.com. And if you'd like to find some of my journalism, and in particular sign up for free to my weekly church news newsletter, The Critical Friend, you can do that via my website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.